so many people talk about there being a pipeline problem. There just aren't enough people of color out there hire.
And if I had a nickel for every time I heard that, it's Willy Wonka stuff.
This is the Righteous Capitalist Podcast, hosted by Doug Zacher. How we make money matters.
Hey, right now, I don't know if you're sitting on your patio or walking around empty streets that are usually inhabited by people going to work. Something like, say, the Wall Street area. What I do know is you're listening to The Righteous Capitalists. I'm your host, Doug Zacher, and I want to thank you for letting us join you in whatever it is you're doing. And speaking of Wall Street, it's no secret that the investment and financial world suffers from an extreme lack of diversity. Despite talking about diversity and inclusion for years, less than 10% of the non-clerical and non-laborer workforce of U.S. financial firms are Black or Hispanic. And according to Bloomberg, women and minorities manage a mere 1.3% of the $69 trillion in financial portfolios, despite getting better returns than their white male counterparts. Yeah, the same Bloomberg analysis found that women and minorities had a return of 6.6% versus 3.9% for white men. Today's righteous capitalist, Troy Prince, founder of Wall Street Bound, lives by the certainty that IQ and talent are evenly distributed across gender, race, ethnicity, and geography, and yet opportunity is most definitely not. And it's that lack of opportunity, or social capital as he puts it, that causes the lack of diversity on Wall Street. Troy knows a little something about Wall Street. After graduating from Bronx High School of Science, where he played tennis and ultimate frisbee, he went on to NYU's Stern School of Business for his undergraduate degree, where he also played lacrosse. While still in college, he made his first stop on Wall Street at Salomon Brothers, and upon graduation in 1992, he headed to Asia, where he has spent most of his trading and investing career. He started Wall Street Bound, which is a nonprofit organization, about a year ago. The vision is for Wall Street Bound to be a pipeline of diverse talent for financial firms. And there's no time like the present, with so many major corporations apologizing for their lack of diversity and even more making renewed pledges to diversify their workforce. But the even bigger vision is to launch a proprietary trading firm called Prometheus Capital Management that is wholly based in inner cities and whose traders all come out of Wall Street Bound. And based on the stats I just mentioned about returns, Prometheus should kick some serious ass. Welcome, Troy.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's dig right into the question of race on Wall Street. And I'll start by asking my audience, what race do you think Troy is based on the introduction I just gave? And what about if I added the part of his bio that I omitted, which is that he was raised in the Bronx by immigrant Caribbean parents? And Troy, I'll start with you by asking your thoughts just around the fact that on paper, as a Bronx Science and Stern graduate playing tennis, lacrosse, and ultimate frisbee and working on Wall Street, most people would assume you're white, or at least most white people would assume you're white.
Absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, growing up, I did get that from peers and people. I'm 49 now, so I grew up in the era where resumes were still faxed in. And, you know, for the thankful to my parents for having a pretty, you know, Troy Alexander Prince. And you would not believe the number of times walking into meetings and you just see those eyes get big and you know exactly what's going on in their heads. You know, I remember growing up several times, people could not believe I was from the Bronx. And the first thought or conclusion always was, no, Connecticut or something. three blocks from Yankee Stadium. But again, you know, that's part of the story. And I'm glad to smash these stereotypes because that's exactly part of what's happening.
Right. So Bronx Science's student body is only 3% Black, right? It goes up to 5% if you add the 2% who are multiracial. And that's still that, you know, 3 or 5% is nothing compared to the fact that basically, you know, all New York City kids are eligible to go to Bronx Science. So, but 25% of the eligible kids for Bronx Science are Black. The sports you've chosen are stereotypically white, and I think they are mostly white. What drove you to do all these things to kind of defy these stereotypes?
So, yeah, I could honestly say, and I've asked myself the question if, you know, was there some part of me that moved deliberately towards these sports because of what, you know, I know they could do for me, or the imagery, the optics of it. But I could honestly say no. You know, tennis, I grew up 3 blocks from Yankee Stadium. Right next door to the old Yankee Stadium was a track and field, and right next door to that were tennis courts. And my father's eldest sister played tennis growing up. They were clay courts. I remember them. Took me to play tennis. I loved it. Lacrosse, I was not even exposed to lacrosse until college, NYU. I can't imagine I even saw the game before that. But, you know, they call it the fastest game on 2 feet. And when I saw it for the first time, I cannot explain it, but I took that stick and spent the summer throwing a ball against the paddleball wall right there in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium until I could handle on both sides. And yeah, so, you know, I knew the benefits, and I would absolutely speak to that when I went on interviews. That's just the reality of it.
Right.
But it's not like I went to them with some deliberate idea that this could help further my career. So I was, guess I could say, fortunate in that way.
Did you ever get any shit from any of your peers about, you know, here's this tennis, frisbee, lacrosse playing guy?
I was labeled the Oreo. I mean, but for me, you know, listen, also part of it's obviously going to Bronx Science, being a teenager. Teenagers generally want to fit in. And so to the degree that if I came home and played Depeche Mode and my father went nuts, I mean, that was part of it. It just, yeah. So I was labeled the Oreo growing up, but it never really fazed me because I was just doing my thing. And that's just what it was.
Would you say that there's one word that would describe sort of why you've succeeded at all these things? Everything from getting into Bronx Science, which ain't easy, all the way on through?
If it had to be one word, I would say parents, but don't tell them I said that.
What about them?
Well, I mean, several things. My mother was a teacher, both parents, you know, Caribbean. My mother's a Caribbean first gen immigrant. She came here when she was 18. So between the culture, between the focus on education, and my father was a disciplinarian. It was amazing for him, you know, didn't have a military background, but, you know, there was no question growing up of, you know, it was always a matter of, you know, I grew up in a family, it was doctor or lawyer. You know, I remember the first big kind of fight, or first time I stood up for myself with my father, was telling him, no, I wanted to go to Wall Street. And I remember the reaction of, like, you know, must have been the same as me telling him I wanted to, you know, stand on the corners or something. It was but, you know, I'd love to obviously attribute it to just my own determination, grit, and just knowing what I wanted to do. But if it had to be boiled down to one word, I obviously cannot take that away from my parents.
Hearing your backstory has everything to do with what you're doing now, in that you are trying to get kids that look like you onto Wall Street. It's sort of assumed that to get a job on Wall Street, you need connections. That it doesn't, you know, you don't find a job posting. There's a chance you could get in without connections. My question is, did you get your start on Wall Street at Salomon Brothers through some connection?
Absolutely not. Back in those days, this is 1990, NYU had a career office, of course, and a job board. Jobs were posted on postcards. And I walked in one day because I wanted to work part-time around school. I obviously knew the name Salomon Brothers, and I saw a posting for an operations position. And the card had been up for maybe 1 or 2 days. And I can absolutely and most shamefully say I took the card off the wall, interviewed, and I remember the boss saying something to the effect of, wow, this is interesting. You know, there hasn't been much of a response from NYU.
So those, you were supposed to just sort of copy down the information off the card?
Of course.
That's great.
Not really.
a little gumption, man. What? Right.
But that's what it was. Truth be told. And so by the time I graduated, I had 2 years of the name Salmon Brothers on my resume. And that obviously just changed everything for me.
But obviously Stern had, you know, being at Stern had something to do with you getting that job. Had you?
So I guess it's how one defines connections. But even then, you know, you peel that back and how many of the population are at Stern, can afford Stern at that time. NYU was the second most expensive school in the country. I think number one was maybe Bard or something.
Right, and of course. So, yeah, I'm agreeing with you that it was, you know, you weren't just some schlub off the street applying for this job. You were in a fairly coveted spot at Stern that, you know, most kids from the Bronx don't have an opportunity to be a part of.
Absolutely not, you know, and still even within Stern, it's the same racial, the demographic story played out. So yeah, I guess it's how you're defining connections, but it's the same story, but definitely not direct. I didn't grow up with anyone in the family who remotely had anything to do with the markets at all. So just is something I found internally at a young age. I read a book, Market Wizards, I think I was maybe 16. And I just knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life and just made it happen.
You talk about social capital and the lack of social capital and the lack of connections that people have.
It's a typical pathway. Yeah. You know, so again, you know, people jump up and down and go to court. I think as far as the Supreme Court on affirmative action. And for us people of color, you know, what do you call it when you walk across the street and ask your neighbor, your uncle, and you ask your dad to bring it up when he's going to play golf with his friends that you're looking for an internship. What do you call that?
Right.
And so we don't have that, you know, and to the degree that we're, you know, our representation at the elite schools where Wall Street goes to recruit, certainly within the fraternities, certainly within the certain sports and teams, which we know is a big pull and a cadre there of where talent comes from. And so I happen to have chosen to play tennis and lacrosse, and that's something I could speak to. But in my mind, I do know that that is part of the story of selling myself to make that corporate environment more comfortable with me. Like, you know, at some point my parents bought a home in Westchester, and for some period of time they were commuting, and we still had the apartment in the Bronx. And intuitively, I knew it just made sense for me to use the Westchester address on my resume.
Wow.
It's just what it is. So, you know, immediately 10451 South Bronx, you know, that was no longer my resume. I just knew it makes a difference.
Right. Interesting. So many people talk about there being a pipeline problem. There just aren't enough people of color out there hire.
Right. We can't find them.
Is that true or is that just total bullshit?
And if I had a nickel for every time I heard that, it's Willy Wonka stuff. It's just not looking in the right place, not being fully committed to looking and certain willingness. And it's just a culture. I guess to some degree, I understand it. For most hiring managers who don't look like me, who don't come from my background, it's a little bit more work. It's more uncomfortable. That's just what it is. But the idea of, you know, I'm one of five. Every one of my siblings have degrees. My sister, one of them, double degrees in psychology from Columbia. Kids I grew up with in my congregation in the Bronx. It's bullywinkle.
Right. Right before we started, I looked up college attendance rates by race. The difference between white college attendance and black college attendance, the difference is only 5%.
Right on.
So you got to assume that points to there really not being a pipeline problem.
Right. No, there isn't. And, you know, I don't know what to say. We know what it really is. I don't want to spend too much time on unconscious bias, et cetera. You know, as far back as I think in the 90s, National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER, put out a study that algorithms pick talent better than humans do because of subjectivity, of unconscious bias. You know, you have a young person that comes in. He has all the academic credentials, et cetera, because he may be, for whatever reason, based on his diversity or anything else, you make a joke, he doesn't laugh. Next thing you know, he's not a cultural fit. I mean, it's just stupid shit.
Yeah. I know you think that Wall Street is the greatest economic engine of all time. I've heard you say that. But there are people, especially lately, who see Wall Street as being of having a destructive side as well. Whether, you know, it's corporations lobbying to pay less in taxes, which leads to crumbling schools and infrastructure, whether they're abandoning U.S. cities for cheaper labor, refusing to invest in inner cities, or hell, just favoring rich white guys. Has it ever crossed your mind that maybe inner city kids just don't want to contribute to that culture?
Absolutely not. First off, inner city kids, for the most part, are not part of the culture, not aware of the depth and of the impact that culture has on the workings of every facet of life globally. Where would we be without capital markets? You know, unless we're all living on a kibbutz, growing our own food, sewing our own clothes, building our own log cabins. Okay, I get that. To the larger question, you know, I think it's a question of economic and political systems. And, you know, I don't want to veer off topic, but I think it's an interesting point to say that capitalism is an expression of free markets. We as a society have yet to experience anything that has done a better job of pulling people out of poverty. Clearly, we know that as it was effected in the past, socialism, communism didn't really do a great job either. So I would argue that the real issue is simply not the ism itself. I mean, if you think about it, capitalism as a political structure, as a mechanism, is an idea, same as socialism, same as communism. It's how we apply it as imperfect humans that all this other conversation comes in. And that's where, of course, there's a conversation there about more responsible capitalism, more inclusive capitalism, and it's absolutely a conversation to have. But in terms of let's do away with capital markets and free economies, I think that's a whole nother conversation.
An argument could be made that a lot of those things that I just described might not be going on if the ranks of the financial world were more diverse and you had more Black voices talking about how these things affect the inner cities. I mean, you name the issue, it affects people disproportionately of color. And if you had people of color in the boardrooms with that perspective, having grown up in the Bronx or Flint or Chicago, these things might not be going on.
Absolutely. I absolutely get that. But to me, when I hear that as an argument in support of efforts like Wall Street Bound to make capitalism, to make the markets more inclusive, not to just blow up the whole system.
Agreed. So what exactly is it that Wall Street Bound is doing to alleviate some of this shit?
Yeah, man. So Wall Street Bound, we launched last summer with what we call an Introduction to Wall Street Bootcamp, one of three programs and initiatives that we focus on. The boot camp is 20 to 25 hours of training where it's an introduction to the history, the industry, career paths, asset classes, technical skills, soft skills. And it's the idea of first getting that interest peaked, getting that light turned on. Then we have what we call the Wall Street Direct program, 100 to 120 hours of training, where it's more in-depth training on the concepts introduced in the boot camps, more in-depth technical work where we go deeper and actually do modeling, for example, stock analysis, stock presentations, et cetera. And the intention there is for students to also leave the program with what we call portable credentials, namely the FINRA, their new SIE, Securities Industry Essentials, which is the new FINRA exam, where as before, you needed to be sponsored to get FINRA licensing. FINRA, the new exam, you only have to be 18, $75, takes an hour and a half, and you now have FINRA on your resume. The second portable credential we focus on, when I speak about it all the time, is the CFA Institute Investment Foundations. CFA has this certification where it's to make people aware of the CFA certification and to get them, start getting them on that learning journey. It's free, it's online. Again, CFA is now on your resume. And those two things alone can absolutely change the trajectory of a young person trying to, once you have that interest, getting a response. Last but not least is something I'm very proud of that we just announced. We announced it in June on CNBC, but we just launched applications for the Diverse Trader Training Program with our partners, Maverick Trading, a proprietary trading firm that's been around for 23 years, focuses on foreign exchange and stock options. Students, upon acceptance, are trained virtually. They trade virtually. And foreign exchange training is 100 hours with mentorship, stock options, 250 hours. And the beauty of this program is it goes beyond traditional financial literacy or financial education. And unlike any other out there that I've even heard of, we actually put capital in the hands of program participants. Program participants start off with $25,000 trading accounts. And as they progress, as they show themselves responsible stewards of capital, over the course of 1 year, those accounts grow to $250,000, and program participants keep 70-80% of profits they generate. And so I think this, you know, Wall Street employs 181,000 people here in New York, but between the ages of 16 and 24, we have 2 million alone. That's only New York City. So I'm always thinking of how intentionally we can connect the virtually unlimited talent with the virtually unlimited capital. And so I think this program can be something special, scalable, impactful in terms of going directly to the markets, connecting the talent directly to the markets. And so I think it's something special and exciting that we just launched last week.
Wow. A ton of questions based on what you just said. The first being with the FINRA licensing, you used to have to be sponsored. What did that mean?
So until October would make 2 years, FINRA is the self-regulatory body for the financial services industry. And so depending on what job you want to do, if there is client or investment facing roles, you have to be licensed. And so it was always the catch 22 of, if I want to get these licenses, a firm has to sponsor me. A firm has to say, we will hire you for one of these roles and we will pay your fees. We'll pay for your for the training for you to sit for this exam. But obviously the catch 22 was, well, you need something to stand out to be hired. So what FINRA did across all those exams was cut out all the basic material, drop it down to one introductory level exam, and made it available to the general public, whomever, wherever, 18 years old, $75, you now get that first FINRA certificate. And then after that, depending on where you want to go within the industry, you take these other exams.
For the higher level exams, do you need to be sponsored for those still?
Yes.
Okay. So people talk about systemic racism. There's an instance right there of it. Yes, that in the end, right, we know that Wall Street is predominantly white, and those white firms, right, you had to have a job with one of those firms in order to just take a damn test. I mean, what a hurdle right there.
Right. You know, I would say absolutely I agree with that. But again, to the degree that, you know, my mission and my purpose is to close that divide, I take it upon myself, and I guess it's part of my outreach to also say, you know, listen, it's incumbent upon myself, organization, my community to also better educate ourselves. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, because again, I'm not here to whine and point fingers, but to the degree that there is certainly an education and awareness campaign or process that generally has not and does not happen within my communities, that's certainly the case, because again, most of us are not growing up with uncles, dads, right, cousins, neighbors who are in the space and are aware of this. And so, yes, that is large burden on the industry itself, but to the degree that it is us that want to get access to these opportunities, clearly part of the mission of Wall Street Bound is also just educational and awareness building.
Right. I was just sort of pointing out, because I was certainly unaware of, you know, some of the hurdles that people face, and that it's like, bravo for FINRA for making a change. Is really my point. Most of what I say typically comes out as finger pointing, even when I'm trying to sort of be congratulatory. But, you know, yay for FINRA for, you know, for noticing that and actually doing something. I can't imagine what it took even internally at FINRA to do that and some of the obstacles that people internally had to deal with just to try to make that happen. How do you recruit?
Largely with my college and university partners. So being a New York-based nonprofit, you know, I've made it part of my mission to just go knocking on doors. And we started off with a campus of CUNY in Brooklyn, Medgar Evers. And, you know, CUNY has, I think, 15 campuses total. And then just, again, outreach, introductions. And so it's generally through college and university partners. We seem to do well with the finance clubs within the schools and then general outreach. Right now in my inbox for the Diverse Trader Training Program, I've got applications from as far as Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
Africa, all the time. Do we have to be American citizens? Do I need to move to New York to join this program? So general social media, but largely through introductions to schools, if not the ones I've already had some contact with.
Right. The Diverse Trader Training Program, which is, did I say that right? That's a kind of a mouthful. With Maverick, they've been training traders for 23 years. How does Maverick typically work and how have they partnered with you in any sort of special way?
Well, the CEO, Darren, was originally a trader, then grew into an HR function, and now the CEO. The firm was founded by Rob, who's still the head trader. You know, these are just normal white guys growing their business. You know, they're just doing their thing. And so I was very intentional of reaching out to shops and say, this is what I'm trying to do. And what's interesting is the proprietary trading world, intuitively, they get it a lot more than actual traditional Wall Street does. You know, traditional Wall Street, regardless, still cares about the social capital, the cultural fit, the GPA, what brand of school did you go to? But to the guys that actually make their bread and butter from purely trading in the markets, risk management, they don't really care because we all know that because you went to Harvard does not necessarily or at all make you a better risk manager and trader. If anything, I'm sure there's arguments out there to say that it's probably detrimental. They have a different lens on what kind of talent it takes to be successful. It's been a much easier conversation. So I reached out to Maverick, and literally within one conversation, the CEO, Darren, was like, I get it. You know, it just so happens, for example, that the Maverick trading motto is changing the world one trader at a time. You know, I didn't make that up.
Right.
And so the idea that they know from experience that the best traders has nothing to do with your GPA, your SAT scores, your brand, what school you went to, or what sports you played. Much easier conversation. And so for me to introduce the idea of let's turn that recruiting lens to a different demographic was just, you know, it's a much easier chat. And Maverick was the first one that stepped up and say, we get it. Let's create a program for this demographic, which essentially is the same as their standard recruiting and trading program. Except, for example, obviously I'm going to run the recruitment process, the interviews, et cetera. That's number one. And so where and how I'm recruiting, interviewing, and the application process is different from what they would normally do. And secondly, there are some fees involved. Prop shops, it's pretty typical to have what's called first loss capital, where you do put down some small amount to just ensure good behavior. So you don't, no one just goes cowboy ballistic and say, hey, I buy 1,000 call options and whatever happens, I walk out the door scot-free. And so vastly reduced capital requirements, reduced cost of the training, which Wall Street Bound is supporting. And so just made it easier in terms of the financial commitment to get access to this training. They tell us they have available capital and seats for up to 500 traders and 500 more traders, I should say. And so again, to the degree that the conversation still remains about the business of trading, no reduction in or no change in expected volatility or risk adjusted returns, because that's exactly what I don't want to do. The idea is we can find productive traders within this community and they don't care what they look like, because at the end of the day, Obviously, Maverick is in the business of making money from the markets, and they do not care who's in those seats. And that's a beautiful conversation I'm trying to have and promulgate. But Maverick is the first one that stepped up and say, let's rock.
Wow, that's great. Congratulations. So recently, 27 New York companies declared they were going to hire 100,000 people from low-income and diverse communities by 2030. So it's 100,000 people. Is that a lot of people?
Absolutely not. And even then, my sense is it's probably just a number and a headline for the moment.
If they need to hire 100,000 people from low-income and diverse communities, that's exactly who you're training. Are they knocking down your door looking for people?
No, but you know, there's a long story there, man. And so I would just say at some point something will likely happen with the council, but to the degree that there is an agenda there, I'll just leave it at that.
Right.
I'm focused on the impact that Wall Street Bound can have with what we're doing.
So for people listening who are a part of these large firms or part of anything else, is there anything you need besides money?
Yeah, well, the other main thing is what I guess nominally the announcement at least speaks to is our seats and quality seats. You know, if you go to these firms in operations and support, it's full of diversity, but you go upstairs where the million-dollar paychecks are, it's a different story. You go up a few flights higher to management, it's a completely different story. So A, it's seats. B, you know, let's have a conversation about the quality of those seats. You know, Wall Street Bound is focused on middle office and front office for a very specific reason. You know, everyone says, let's just get them jobs or let's just get them in the door. That's great. But we've seen for 50, 70 years that they seem to never really, the elevator doesn't get sent back down.
Right. Part of this pledge, it's 100,000 people, right? It's a number. It's a target.
And it's not only finance. I'm pretty sure there's some technology in there as well.
For sure. Yeah. Amazon is a part of it. Google's a part of it.
Right.
But a while back, or certainly over the course of our lifetimes, you and I are the exact same age, graduated from high school the same year, from college the same year. Over the course of our lifetimes, the word quota seems to have become a dirty word.
Right.
And yet it seems without a quota, shit's not happening.
Yes, yes, yes.
How do you get around that?
Yeah, you know, that came up last night. So CNBC had a special on last night on this subject, and that came up. And it's hard because quota absolutely turns people off. I totally get that. But yet, as you mentioned, without having, it does not seem to change. And, you know, I'll throw out an idea that has come up but never seems to get much traction. You know, I bet you if you tied CEO compensation to numbers, this shit would change overnight. But,
right.
You know, otherwise, in my lane, what I can speak to is ideas that are not necessarily novel, but why aren't there more, for example, blind resumes where without names, without addresses, without any markers, just based on the merits of the resume itself, you know, that small change alone, redacting, let's say, address, names, just imagine the effect that would have on the recruiting process overall just by that small thing with known as blind resumes. And so, you know, small things that people can do, but again, it always just comes down to a certain willingness and or ability within people themselves. But, you know, peel that back again. If most of the hiring managers are white and there is no real accountability, certainly accountability to either P&L and or their own compensation, you know, I'm not quite sure what the tip of the spear looks like to really push it over the edge without quotas.
Right. I mean, one of my favorite all-time lines from The Righteous Capitalist is from Jill Johnson, who had pointed out that of all business goals in the corporate world, why is it that diversity is the one that people are willing to fail at? Right? they're not willing to fail on revenue. They're not willing to fail on cost reduction. They're not willing to fail on so many things. And yet diversity, it's, oops, sorry, we tried.
Well, I mean, listen, Doug, that's a function of our society and the industry. You know, I guess even, yeah, society, industry is a small expression of the larger society. And listen, at the end of the day, honestly, we all know no one really gives a sugar. That's just what it is. And to the degree that society allows the industry to get away with it, status quo to continue, that's what it is. And so what I can do, what I choose to do, is focus on the, not necessarily the demand side, but the supply side. I can certainly be a Pied Piper to make the community, the larger community, aware of the talent that exists, make the talent and those communities aware of the opportunities, and have them prepared as best as I can once that opportunity arrives. That's what I can do.
Right. But from what you've told me, your plans are to affect the demand side as well via Prometheus. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the vision of Prometheus, which when I first saw your profile on LinkedIn, that is what caught my eye, was Prometheus, was the idea of having a investment management equities trading firm, whatever it is. You'll tell us in a second. Actually, you know what? I'm not even going to describe it. You describe it. What the hell am I doing?
So, thank you for that. You know, ultimately to me, I think, what is scalable? The talent we know is virtually unlimited. We know capital is unlimited. B, where are the jobs needed? Where are the cost of operations lowest? You know, what's the point of me training kids on cash flow modeling and whatever asset it is, whether it's a stock, whether it's a private company, whether it's real estate? They go downtown, do their jobs for whomever in a real estate department, and come back home to a neighborhood of depressed property values. To me, that's ludicrous longer term. And so the idea of this talent and the skills being applied in their own communities with profits reinvested just makes logical sense to me. And so the ultimate vision is for Prometheus Capital, this idea I have where I see no reason why Wall Street Bound through Prometheus cannot have trading rooms in the hood with profits reinvested in the community, and the talent stays within the community, the profits stay within the community, and it's scalable only to the limit of available capital. And so that's the ultimate vision where this goes, because again, you know, to me, to go downtown, as exciting as it might be and the nice name on the business card, but you come back home to depressed property values and neighborhoods where, like the Bronx, where I think it's less than 20% own their homes, it does not make sense. And so how do we bring this knowledge, how do we bring this experience back to bear where it's needed the most in a scalable, sustainable fashion? It's not charity, it's business, but it's simply who's executing and who the benefits are going towards.
I love that. I mean, that to me is the sweet spot of all of it. It's capitalism, but it's thoughtful, it's non-destructive, non-exploitive. Is there a timeline for getting Prometheus off the ground?
Prometheus really is, I think, a couple of iterations of the DTTP, of the process of optimizing the recruiting and training process, and then capital becoming available to me. So it's more so a function of time.
Right.
Largely a function, again, of funding.
Right. Or perhaps someone, who was the guy who was speaking at Morehouse, he was speaking at, and he decided to pay off everybody's student loans?
Robert F. Smith.
Yes. Maybe he'll just come along and say, that's a great idea.
Brother, I am sending out all kinds of silent prayers to reach this guy's ears. He and a few other amazing names, you know, Paul Tudor Jones, they just need one check. It's insignificant to them, but for us, it could be. I think the idea of Prometheus itself, we're talking generational change. I dare call it revolutionary, but just simply to the way we're applying market knowledge, it's, you know, I'm talking generational change.
Right. We've had plenty of guests who talk about an alternative system, that there's one system that isn't working, right? We've gone over it and over and over and over ad nauseum how much the current system is not working for people of color, people from inner cities. So why not develop an alternate system?
Absolutely. You know, and again, it just speaks to, you know, the name of the podcast. It's not to do away with capitalism itself, but certainly to take its core and how it's being applied and who the benefits are going to, there is a better way. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I think the creating an alternate system also circumvents what I think is, you know, is really the biggest hurdle, which is people choosing to take less. So in, you know, in the hiring scenario that you had mentioned earlier, there are two candidates. There's a person of color and, you know, I'm the hiring manager. There's a person of color and there is my fraternity brother. That's who we're down to. Most people would say human nature would have me pick my fraternity brother, when in the end, my values and my conscience would really say, no, let's take the other guy. And yet people, for the most part, have and will likely continue to choose that fraternity brother.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there's a bunch of assumptions there, and it is just the reality of, I would think the other assumption is assuming that people actually live according to their value systems, and we know that's absolutely not the case. But, you know, listen, Doug, again, I get it. It's not like I wake up every morning concerned with and thinking about the plight of child sweatshop labor in Chinatown or something. And I get it. It's just everyone intuitively and naturally is focused on what they know based on their own backgrounds, et cetera. And if there is no system of accountability, it is what it is.
Right. But you also didn't just leave some, you know, some 2-day workshop talking about child labor. Right. I mean,
yeah,
one of the assumptions is that people are trying to educate folks, to educate hiring managers to make those correct choices. And yet they're still not.
If you're forced to take a diversity class or a class in unconscious bias, that's one thing. It's obviously a completely different matter for that, the essence of that training and what it really means to become part of your consciousness, part of your value system.
Right. No, I trust me. I get it. You know, part of it is, you know, I will continue to, you keep saying you don't want to whine. You know, I'll keep whining about my white brethren and how, you know, that same person who hired their fraternity brother not only went through bias training, but there's a decent chance they've just given money to the NAACP, the ACLU, right, to a food bank, you know, you name it. They see the problem. There is that moment where somebody has to take less or give up something or disappoint their friend, right? It's gonna cost us something, right? Gonna cost people something to do this.
Well, that something, Doug, is very simple. It's without having social connections, personal interactions, personal experiences, that makes a difference. I mean, remember, before Cheney's daughter came out of that conversation, you know, his stance obviously was different.
Right.
And so that's part, again, of the other side of that social capital conversation, where the benefit and the mission of a Wall Street Bound is to, again, intentionally create that pathway, not only through technical training, but at the end of the day, is simply to create those human and fosters human connections. It's really where it begins. And so what I can do, what Wall Street Bound can do, is continue to pull these two universes together through technical training, social capital, and increased awareness and education.
Right. Do you think, I mean, really part of that education is shining a spotlight on some of these statistics about performance?
Absolutely. I just posted on this last night. I post every now and then on it, because that's the beauty of the markets to me. The beauty of this space for Prometheus Capital and the markets, you know, the markets for me, and one of the things I thought about in launching Wall Street Bound with direct contact with the markets is, I guess, back to where we were with the catch-all of cultural fit. You know, there will always be that catch-all, that excuse as to why a person is not suitable for that job. You put a body in front of the computer with an account, the results speak for themselves. So everything else goes out the window if you are truly, as the street claims to be, or as men claim to be, data-driven. And so to the degree that there is accountability to data and performance, that's what I love about this space. That's what I'm trying to bring. So at some point when we have a slew of returns and they're analyzed, you know, sharp ratios and everything else, the data speaks for itself. And that's where I think will eventually be the game changer.
Right. It's not unlike sports, right? I mean, sports are performance driven, right? Nobody cares what anybody looks like as long as they're performing.
Think about it, Doug. 50, 60 years ago, we couldn't even play professional sports in this country.
All right. So maybe this is a little too much like sports.
No, but that's good. That's good because at some point, some school, some coach, some manager says, I want to win. And when that becomes the, you know, all the other stuff aside,
right,
then the company changes. And the way we do that is, again, being a capitalist society, a firm like Maverick, a firm like hopefully other partners we find that says, we don't care, we want to win. That's where all the stuff goes away, which is why that diverse trader training program is special to me in terms of how it takes this conversation to another level, beyond whining, beyond asking for seats, beyond begging for donations. It's look, the talent is there.
Right.
Look and perform. All that other stuff in your brain, all that other stuff you have to say, we can't find them, the culture fit. I leave that to you with your thoughts now.
Yeah, I guess an argument could be made that the financial world is simply underperforming because there are too many white guys in it.
Well, that is a fact. That's data driven. You quoted, you quoted some stats yourself. That's just what it is.
Right.
And again, the other side of that conversation, you know, the industry in some quiet space with themselves, I leave that conversation to them alone.
Right, right. Hopefully they will figure it out. It seems like you have hit upon something that is important. It's needed. And I wish you the best of success.
Thank you. It's my life's mission. I've had this idea for 15 years. It's my full time now. And, you know, if not me, first gen Caribbean immigrant from the Bronx, who?
As we just said, you know, not everybody does. Not everybody lives their values. It is quite obvious that you are, which has made you an ideal guest. And I can't thank you enough for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And certainly thank you for extending the platform. I'm glad to have this time with you and your audience.
One goal of this podcast is to change the meaning of the phrase business is business from something negative to something positive. For instance, wouldn't it be great to hear we've scaled back executive bonuses this year instead of laying off 200 people because business is business? Well, this episode with Troy makes me want to destroy another cliche that's let people off the hook. That phrase is, it's not what you know, it's who you know. While that phrase has helped motivate plenty of people to get out from behind their desks or out from behind their school books and network their way to a job, I'll go out on a limb and say that based on the statistics mentioned in this episode and the reality we heard described by Troy, the repetition and reinforcement of this phrase has most definitely contributed to the racial wealth and income gaps. It's all too clear that when economic opportunity is distributed based on who you know, it will remain amongst those who have already succeeded and who already know one another, and it will remain with them for generations. As Troy so accurately put it, it's affirmative action for those who already have resources. And I'll add, who are white. This thought does add a little irony to Troy's suggestion of compensating people based on hitting diversity goals. But hey, if more money reminds Jamie Dimon that he believes in racial equality, economic justice, and that diversity leads to a more successful company, then I guess that's where we gotta go. Blind resumes sound like a wonderful idea too, but why not take it a step further and have blind interviews? I'm sure someone's already figured that one out. And while we're on the subject of stupid phrases used in business, why is there so much reliance on the hiring process being personal? But then when someone is fired, they get the old, it's not personal, it's business. Which brings me back to the need to make business is business a positive phrase. I mean, considering all of the untapped talent that's out there and that's been sidelined by hiring practices that rely on relationships instead of talent, wouldn't it be great to hear one fraternity brother say to another fraternity brother, "Hey, I love you, man. We've got our secret handshake and those Hell Week memories, but you didn't get the job. I hired a black woman who will add more to our team. I'm sorry I couldn't give you the job, but business is business." To learn more about or contribute to Wall Street Bound, go to wallstreetbound.org. That's all one word, wallstreetbound.org. As always, thank you for listening and for taking this journey with us.
This has been the Righteous Capitalist Podcast with Doug Zacher. To learn more, suggest a Righteous Capitalist for the show, or to subscribe, visit us at therighteouscapitalists.com or find us on all social media platforms with the handle Doug Zacher, the Righteous Capitalist Podcast, how we make money matters.
All right.